Welcome to the Stay Informed podcast. I'm your host, Tom Oshowitz of Informed, and today we're going to talk about the status of legislative efforts to regulate artificial intelligence. To dive into this topic, we're so lucky to have my former colleague and a true expert in the space, Yolanda McGill. Yolanda is Deputy General Counsel and Vice President of Policy and Government Affairs for ZSAI. Yolanda, welcome to the show. Welcome to Stay Informed.
Thanks, Tom. It's great to be here.
Well, Lena, maybe we could just start by, if you could just tell us a little bit about your background at the CFPB and more about also what you're doing today at Zest. I'd love to hear.
Yeah, sure. So hi, everyone, to all the listeners out there. My name's Yolanda McGill. And for the last year and a half, I have been at Zest AI. So just prior to moving into the private sector, I spent almost 8 years at the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, and I was a supervising attorney in the Office of Regulations. Prior to going to the Bureau, I actually have been in the consumer advocacy space, working at think tanks and national advocacy organizations. I've got decades, I guess, under my belt, focused on anti-predatory lending, focused on fighting foreclosure rescue fraud during the financial crisis. And so I'm a deputy general counsel at Zest AI, and I head up policy and government affairs there.
And I, if you could tell me a little bit more about Zest AI, because I remember back in my days at the Bureau that Zest was really one of the first companies to really, you know, look at AI in financial services. And maybe you could tell us a little bit more about what Zest does and, you know, some of the topics that you're confronting in that space.
Great question. Thank you for that. Because as I've been out meeting people, you know, I run into former Bureau colleagues and other people in the space who are familiar with Zest. But I think they're actually more familiar with a prior iteration because Zest was operating under a different flag and a different business model and a different set of leadership for a while. The organization itself has been around since 2009. So, you know, in the tech startup space, it's actually been around for quite a bit. But in 2018, there was a leadership change at Zest AI and a dramatic business model change. So the current business model is a B2B model. It is not consumer facing, and that will be relevant later on when we talk about legislative efforts. And we are a developer of artificial intelligence technology. Specifically, we build models. So that, I think, is also an important for the listeners to understand about Zest, because that's also something that I run into a lot, is that people don't understand that Zest AI develops and builds models. Specifically, we build underwriting models for our clients, which are financial institutions. And we also have patented technology to debias models.
Well, I think it's so interesting because when people think about AI, there's sort of two types of folks. I think when they think about AI policy, there are those who think AI policy began when ChatGPT emerged in late 2022, early 2023. And then there's folks who have been working on the issue when machine learning and deep learning and other types of models came out in the last, you know, 10 or 15 years. And, you know, my sense of Zest is that it's a company that's not a toddler, but a teenager, or at least an adult in the room when it comes to AI policy. So thrilled to have you here. And I guess I do have to make one last plug for you, which is I understand that you are also the first ever chair of the CFPB Alumni Association. Tell me, what's going on there? What's going on? That's great. You know, we're old enough to have the Alumni Association.
Yes, no, I'm super excited. So first of all, yes, for all of those hardworking folks who were slogging away in the trenches of the CFPB, like you, like me, like, you know, thousands of others, we now have an official alumni association. It is a 501c3. So, you know, prior Bureau colleagues have come together. We are a board of 12, of which, as you mentioned, I'm the chair, and it's super exciting. So, yeah.
So cool. Well, hey, now I think we're going to dive into some of the meat of this the podcast and start talking about AI policy, because, you know, one of the things that's so interesting about this space is we have really a, what we could call, one might call a breaking change technology. And the question is, how is government, how are regulators approaching this? And I just wanted to, you know, touch base. You've gone from the inside of the government to the outside. And are you talking to members of Congress or state regulators about AI policy? And what are you hearing?
So yes, the answer is yes. You know, Zest has always been engaged with policymakers. So even before I got there, the chief legal officer now was definitely hitting up the push to, for instance, draft comment letters, take meetings, issue white papers, issue blogs, because there is a need for clarity in the conversations and a need for precision in the conversations and a need for, quite frankly, practitioners and technologists, people who are actually grappling with the tech, to be part of the conversations, right? Legislators hear a lot from advocates, and advocates are important in the ecosystem. You know, I did that myself for a very long time. They're hearing a lot from, you know, academics, but some of these things are theoretical issues, right? Or they might be issues that are not relevant to the particular use case. So for instance, you know, in the advocacy community, there is rightfully concern about the use of biometric information and how it can be imprecise and be biased and be used unfairly in certain communities. You know, in the defense, you know, sector, or when it comes to talking about elections, people are concerned about deep fakes and the ability to generate personas or to impersonate prominent figures, but none of that is being used in financial services, you know? And so there's this need to sort of make sure that a legislator or a policymaker or whomever stakeholder has matched their concern, you know, with the tech, you know, with the issue, with the outcome that, you know, and so I do think that I've seen increasing sophistication around that on the Hill, which is great. Both chambers, you know, Senate and House, are taking a measured, deliberate approach, and they are having listening sessions, fora, work, you know, roundtables, working groups. I mean, they're calling these iterations of the conversations all types of things, but they are at least trying to take some time to pull together sort of, you know, prioritization around where and how they're going to engage. It doesn't mean that there's not 200 some odd AI bills sitting out there, but we as a caucus, we as a set of leaders in a chamber, we want to lay out, you know, the priorities that we think are important and sort of give some suggestions to the committees of jurisdiction. So that's the way it's operating up there right now, which is good. And I think what I've been trying to do is, again, make sure that there are technologists in the room. And, you know, I've sat and listened in on some testimony that has not been as precise as it could have been because there were not technologists on the panel. And so, you know, a couple of wrong statements sends a policymaker down a line of, oh my goodness, how are we going to combat this bot? For instance, one example, concrete example, you know, for instance, how are we going to combat this bias that is clearly prevalent in these underwriting models if they continue to learn while they're in production? Right. No, I was watching a panel. Two of the three witnesses said, I saw you shaking your head, Tom, but two of the three experts said that underwriting models are dynamic and continue to learn. And so then you've got these senators being like, oh my goodness, what in the world? We got to do something. I'm like, oh my God, wait.
Well, there's so many things I want to unpack from your statement there. So I'm going to start with the first one, which is, the first comment is about pace of legislation. At one point in my career, which also spans multiple decades, I worked on the Hill. And I remember there were some bills like the Amber Alert legislation, which I worked on, where senators passed the bill in 4 days, 98-0. It was a bill to basically create a national funding mechanism for Amber Alerts. I also worked on data breach legislation in 2003. And as of 2024, there's still no national data breach bill. And so I guess the first question is sort of a quick sense from you is, how fast is AI legislation going? Are we talking somebody's going to get done this Congress, or is this a multi-year, multi-stage process? What's sort of the pace of this legislation?
Well, it's interesting. So I don't think we're in Amber Alert territory, but I also don't think we're in data breach territory. I do think, though, it's going to be multi-year. And I wouldn't have said that, I think, maybe 6 months ago. But what I heard a year ago from folks was, you know, we got to do something about AI. It's just going too fast. It's nuts. It's crazy. Of course, meanwhile, you had the Biden administration sort of putting out, I think, on a steady drumbeat, things like the NIST framework and the AI Bill of Rights, the blueprint, and all of which have, certain concepts that have been taken, have been developed here domestically, but also, are informed by, what's been happening in the EU. But there was also this sentiment that nobody was going to touch data. A bunch of people in the AI community were like, well, what about data privacy? What about data management? What about data, permissible uses? Like, what about data? That feels like a fundamental place to start. And experts, congressional experts were like, oh yeah, no, data privacy is a third rail. Nobody in Congress wants to touch data. And so, we were like, huh, that's interesting. That has changed. I don't know what
Well,
changed.
so I want to sort of follow up on a point you made, which is that it's years away. Back in the day, the last time we had a seismic technology was the growth of the internet. And I remember back in the mid-90s, the idea was this is this new virgin, perfect territory. We don't want people who don't understand the technology to mess it up. Let the internet prosper, let it grow. My sense is history never repeats itself, although it sometimes may be related. What is your sense? Are we going to let AI just develop, or do you think that there's going to be a more proactive, more hands-on approach to AI regulation this time around than it was towards the internet in the past? I'm just curious what your view is on that.
I think it'll be more proactive. I think there's a lot of concern in both ways, right? Like, there's a lot of concern around the potential for harm that AI, and I say the AI, can create. And I think there's also a lot of concern around stifling innovation. Like, so, with those two poles of concern, I haven't seen anyone really say, let's just sit back and let the market, handle this. Like, so whether it's a lot of proactivity around supporting research, whether it's a lot of proactivity around supporting, workforce development and education, whether it's a lot of proactivity around national security, whether it's a lot of proactivity around combating bias, wherever. So if somebody is saying let folks prosper, then they still want to put a lot of money and a lot of sort of domestic development behind it. If people are saying we want to protect folks, then they're going to be, aiming that way. And so what I would add to that, though, is more appreciation of the nuance, and more appreciation around there should be maybe some risk ranking, and some focus on some types of AI, some types of use case more so than others, and as that begins to emerge, I think that is actually a really beneficial turn of events, and that says to me that the members of Congress that are looking at this kind of appreciate the moment. And it's not like this has been the first round of AI task forces, right? I think some of the folks who are on current AI task forces, this is like their third one. Like, I mean, Congress has been looking at this, here and there. So I think they're also building up their knowledge banks as well. And so again, I appreciate the deliberation. And so, but a multi-year thing, I mean, it's like, I would think maybe two. And especially again, because like I said, data is back on the table.
What, Yelena, what are the, before we go into the meat of the legislation, one last question I had is the business perspective. When we are talking to our prospective clients, it's funny, we hear sort of almost like a split view. On the one hand, people are super excited and like, gosh, I really want to use this stuff. I want to start implementing and getting value. And there's another part of the organization, which is like, I'm afraid of it. Let's halt all use of it till we understand what's going on. Or they might say, guess what? Don't use it, but if you do use it, we own it all. So I'm just curious what you're experiencing. What's your sense of how companies you're working with are reacting to this sort of AI regulatory landscape?
So, we're working with banks and credit unions, and the Prudentials, it seems like there's a little bit of a spectrum as far as they're encouraging their institutions' usage of advanced technology. So, and then we also, of course, have consumer protection regulators. So I would throw the FTC in there.
By the way, just for our audience, could you explain what a prudential is, just as they may not know what a prudential is?
Sure, yes. Like, so, in our banking system, we have regulators that are in charge of safety and soundness for these banking institutions. And so we call them the prudential regulators. They're the primary, more or less, federal regulators for these banks and for the credit unions. So that's, you know, the National Credit Union Administration, for instance, or the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency for national banks. We have the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation that insures deposits, what, up to $250,000. And so they are also a prudential. We've got the Federal Reserve Board for certain state banks that is also a federal regulator. You know, the CFPB then is on the side and has joint jurisdiction, not really counted as a prudential, not in charge of safety and soundness, but certainly is the primary regulator for the big banks, the too big to fail banks. Listeners will remember that term from back in the day. So, but a consumer protection regulator, along with the Federal Trade Commission, who's got jurisdiction over the non-bank, like non-financial services.
You're saying that there's different folks. Approaches to each of these. Well, each of these folks have slightly different approach. Who's like the most forward-leaning from your view of these regulators? That's
the NCUA.
Really? Wow. That's interesting.
I mean, the NCUA is really thoughtful and really forward-leaning. I mean, what, right? I mean, for credit unions, because I think Chairman Harbor is, you know, and the other board members, Vice Chair Hauptmann, they're really sort of focused on credit union survival, right? Like, and thinking, you know, a lot of credit unions are really small. A lot of credit unions are trying to serve communities that might be more challenging to serve. They are, you know, mission-driven. They're focused on particular fields of membership. You know, and so they, you know, in some credit unions, it's like, what, one person or two people? I mean, you know, they're doing a lot with very little in some circumstances. And they're encouraging, you know, these entities to explore, you know, reliable tech to, you know, to reach people, to be more efficient and get to people so that they don't then go down the street to maybe, you know, a lender that would be, you know, less than ideal. And so the NCUA is really sort of thinking about this a lot and is more open to their entities, you know, so exploring more, you know, technology and more use cases. I think, you know, obviously across the board, you know, regulators don't want to be surprised, you know, and they want to have a sense that the entity understands what they're using and has a specific sort of like outcome and use in mind and isn't just like getting the shiny thing just for the sake of getting the shiny thing. But yeah, I would say NCUA is leaning in. And I think, you know, the other regulators are more like, you know, we've heard things, we have concerns, we want to know that you know what's going on. Obviously, we had the joint statement come out, what was that, about a year ago? Whereby, you know, the regulators were like, look, there's no tech exception to compliance.
Right.
With financial services and obligations. And I think, when I saw that, I was like, right, because that actually buttresses what we say, you know, at Zest AI, when we're engaging with regulators and also when we're engaging with our clients. It's like, look, this is just a tool. Your activities are regulated activities, you know, and we are just providing you a tool to do that activity better. We think not only does our tool facilitate your compliance, but when it comes to sort of like fair lending, we actually think it, you know, it boosts your compliance. It actually makes, you know, it takes you past compliance into reality, which quite frankly is what the promise of AI and, you know, the AI driven tools, you know, we're artificial intelligence and machine learning. So we're in the machine learning space. But what we really think these tools can do is take institutions past the status quo that quite frankly hasn't been working for a lot of people, even though institutions have been compliant, right. You know, we still have bias, you know, in lending. We still have people who are locked out of reasonable access to reasonable and affordable and, you know, responsible credit. And we think that, you know, artificial intelligence and machine learning can make a real difference there. And we do think that regulators understand that, like that bank, you know, the regulators understand that promise, but, you know, certainly, you know, some of the things, especially that we've heard out of the Bureau, it's sort of all over the place. It's been hard for me to kind of follow some of these pronouncements, because the threads I've been able to pull, and it's not like they don't really weave together, but there's a concern from the Bureau that people are going to engage in complexity for complexity's sake. They're gonna try to call it artificial intelligence, even though it might not actually be artificial intelligence. It might just be that you don't know what the heck it is. And so they don't wanna see any of that. They are calling out the need for people to engage in finding the search for less discriminatory alternatives. In lending, that's an area where we have spent a lot of time and done a lot of research, and we think our tech actually facilitates a process that has been difficult to do with more analog tools, right? And so
I did want to actually ask you about that question, which is there's been a lot of discussion prior to this explosion of generative AI about transparency and explainability and how to use machine learning models. Are legislators even understanding the nuances between different types of AI, or are they lumping it all together? You know, because my sense is that there are different issues, right? Like if you're doing generative models, you have issues of hallucinations and you have issues of model governance. And if you have, you know, machine learning models or deep, you know, other models where you're making decisions, there's issues of transparency. Is this all getting lumped together, or people tracking the silos?
It's getting better, but there is some lumping. And I think the lumping happens when they hear about the concern, right? Like if, you know, when they hear of the complaint or the concern or the issue, I think there has not been as much diligence at tying the issue to the particular AI or to the particular use case, you know? And so, you know, so the point that you just, the differentiation that you just made, I think that is not, that doesn't happen as much as it needs to. And again, I think though that some of that's because the conversations are often between people on the ground who are hearing concerns from a consumer, from a layperson, you know, and a policymaker, and those folks don't have as good a grip on the tech or the applications. We have those seen, like there's some people in Congress that are, you know, computer scientists like Ted Lieu. There are some people who are going back to school to get their master's, like Don Beyer in computer science. So, you know, I mean, there are some folks on the Hill who have a better understanding of these things. And like I said, I think it's getting better.
If imagine I'm a chief compliance officer for a lender, or say for a credit union, and I'm trying to say, hey, what's actually going on the Hill? What's getting passed? What isn't going passed? What are the trends? Could we talk a little bit about what you're seeing? I just wanted to, if you had to sort of identify some of the major themes of AI legislation, what are the buckets? Are these discrete compartments? Are they big bills? What are the types of bills that are coming out?
Data, you know, so data and data privacy, you know, I think is really a big one. National security and securing elections is huge. And, you know, if you're a credit union compliance officer, you know, what I actually have seen is a little bit more of some space and grace being given with respect to financial institutions, you know, sort of like the pressing matters, or like sort of like national security and things like that. The states have been really focused on trying to come up with horizontal frameworks that I think sit more closely or more cumbersome for financial services. There is less of this kind of space and grace around what these entities are kind of already doing with respect to model governance and third-party risk management. And so if I was a compliance officer, I'd be paying attention to the state legislation, because those attempts at sector agnostic AI regulation are not nearly as principles based as some other frameworks. And there are very specific obligations that compliance officers are going to need to be looking at around disclosures of the type of tech that you're using and in what fashion. Around these impact assessments. These are impact assessment concepts, are things that we've seen, you know, like say in the NIST framework and in the AI Bill of Rights, but these are going to be prescriptive, like this impact assessment needs to have these 10 things in it, you know, and it needs to be filed with our civil rights office, right, you know, right, state, right. Or it needs to be given to the attorney general upon request, you know. So these are the types of things that are coming out of state bills. I'm sure your listeners know that Colorado has passed the first comprehensive AI law. The governor did sign it, holding his nose, sort of. But he did sign it. So I think the expectation is that over the next year or two, because it's got a 2-year effective date window, that there would be some changes made to it. The governor asked that the legislature go back and make some changes to it. Meanwhile, it is on the books.
If I can sort of drill down on that, I mean, one overarching theme, if you think about privacy or legislation, there's sort of the US approach versus the European approach. And back in the day, people always said, you know, US is sectoral and the Europeans tend to go for the big picture. I think it's happened again in this space where, you know, the European, as I understand, I'm not an expert, but they talk a little bit about a general framework for AI, that's a law that's been passed here, where you have high risk uses and generative AI models, and they have more governance. And my sense, and correct me if I'm wrong, is that Colorado is sort of like the placeholder for a European approach to AI coverage. You go, as you said, to a horizontal framework, they're higher risk. So it's really interesting that this is coming out. And to your earlier point, this is year one, right? The fact that we have a state law that's a general approach, that's just fascinating to me that it's already coming out that way. And the question, of course, is, as you also pointed out, they passed a law, but they passed a law and said, we're not going to implement it until 2026. And so we'll see what happens there. But so there's this larger theme of high risk, but it's happened in one state. And I guess in another state, Connecticut, it didn't make it, right? So we'll see how that goes. How about some other themes? I mean, I algorithmic discrimination, I know it's something that Seth has put a lot of effort into and thinks about. I know the Bureau's looked at that as well. Where is that in the discussion right now? It seems a big part of it, right? Because it seems like discrimination is a big, from a consumer perspective, that's really almost at the top of the list. But you tell me.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. I mean, I think, you know, there is a lot of discussion about algorithmic discrimination and algorithmic bias. I think something that we see as maybe somewhat short-sighted is that these state bills are focused on bias that could be perpetuated by algorithms, but they are narrowly focused on AI. And so algorithms are not new. Algorithms have been in use in various sectors for decades, certainly in financial services. And there are certainly existing applications of algorithms that are biased and are creating inclusion problems when it comes to financial services, when it comes to credit access, credit scoring, all of that. And, you know, we as a company have been using AI, developing AI tools, thinking about how AI can fight that existing status quo of algorithmic discrimination.
And that's such an important point.
Here we are, right, in a situation where our new technology is about to be constrained for fear of it creating algorithmic discrimination, but the legislation doesn't address at all the existing algorithm discrimination, and instead it is about to be codified, as it were, because new technology is at risk of being severely constrained, and so we've those are the conversations that we're trying to have, but because of the commitment to the sector agnostic approach, it is often difficult to have that specific conversation because, you know, the legislator is like, but we're trying to do this umbrella. It's like, well, yeah, but there's not enough flexibility within the umbrella to acknowledge that certain sectors are in different places. And it's not acknowledging the current state of algorithmic discrimination that preceded the explosion of the use of artificial intelligence. Like, let's just talk about algorithms. Like, if we're talking about algorithms, then all the algorithms should be stopped from discriminating, and not just the new ones that actually have promise of unwinding some of the existing bias that we have out there.
So. Lynn, I think that's such an important point. And I 2 points I want to highlight from what you said. Point number one is that technology, AI didn't invent bias. And in fact, AI, I mean, to quote Yann LeCun or Andrew Ng, you can correct algorithm. It's easier to correct an algorithm than it is to correct an inherent bias in a person. So that's point number one. The other point is that, you know, some of the models that folks like you are developing, it's my understanding that you can actually debias. So you can take the environment bias that's out in the world and say, hey, a second, we have a, the data that people get in credit reports, the data that people get in bank accounts, all sorts of places, they are part of society and they reflect a lot of society's biases. You can go in with your technology and actually make things, quote, fairer. Or, you know, so that's just super, super exciting. And so more power to you. I hope you have two voices or six voices and keep on saying that message out there. It's so important and so great. So thank you for that. That is interesting. Do you think that, how receptive is the message? Are people getting that message? Is it, you think people are hearing it, or is it not? Where are we at in that fight for understanding the importance of debiasing?
So I really think that, you know, the more voices on this, the better, you know, and the power of technology, and really just what you said about, you know, I do think because there are concerns, I mean, I was, you know, in a talk yesterday, and, you know, with experts who've been looking at, you know, various use cases and working with AI, working with developers. But the, you know, the shorthand was like, well, you know, people are concerned because these models are opaque. And I'm like, excuse me, like, not all models are opaque. It's like, well, people are just concerned because people don't understand what's in the model. Hello. I work at a company where we are focused on making sure that people understand what's in their model, you know, and it's like, if people aren't careful, you know, and thoughtful about how they are engaging, then we're really going to have, we're just going to keep spinning our wheels here. And so I do think that the more practitioners and the more sort of like people who truly understand their window, they might not know it all, you know, but if you can go to your policymaker or your legislator or make sure the people you're educating folks so that everybody doesn't think that every model is ChatGPT. It's just not like that is not the sole application, but that's the thing that's captivated people's imagination. And I will say that once we can get under that, once we can say, we're not talking about that, let's put that to the side for a second. You know, let's just talk about, you know, predictive analytics. Like, let's just talk about basic math and science. Like, talk about game theory. I mean, that's what we do at Zest AI. We talk about game theory. You know, people go, what? Like, yeah, that's right. Let's slow down and let's talk math and science and data, you know, and the objectivity that can bring, the ability to reverse engineer that can bring, the visibility that can bring, you know. So it's not meant to supplant human judgment. You know, it is not meant to replace your underwriter. You still need your financial institution's credit policy, you still need the board, you still need all those things, you even still need your loan origination system. Like, it's just a tool that helps you better see and evaluate. And you can go back and be like, hey, like, we need to make some adjustments. It is so much better than just doing things the way you've been doing it for the last 20, 30 years and hoping for the best. And so, you know, I think that there is, especially again, when we are working with our clients, they're typically clients that are trying to do the right thing, but they're also trying to find a better way to do the right thing. If they're trying to reach certain communities and they know they want to increase those numbers, you know, they're like, we know these folks, like, we know they're credit worthy. Why are we not able to make these loans?
Right.
They want to have a tool like ours that helps them assess their creditworthy borrowers in a more nuanced way. And so that they can get that, you know, that increase, you know, our folks see on average a 40% lift in protected class approvals without increasing any risk. And so why would you not want to use technology? And I think regulators are on board with that, you know, but again, as long as people know what it is that they are using. And I think, you know, in the talk that I was having yesterday as well, because of not only, you know, the state laws, but also the NIST framework and some of the other recommendations that are coming out, this concept of the impact assessment and the third party audit, you know, and you understand this as well, is going to be really important. And, you know, what we don't want to see and what I would recommend is like, the entity still needs to know what's in their model. You can't just rely on a good housekeeping seal from an external third party. It should be a conversation between the deployer, so the user of the model, and whoever's providing that impact assessment, whether they're doing it themselves or whether somebody else is doing it for them. Everybody should know what's in their model, and be able to think, or at least know how it's been built, the data that went into it, all of those types of things. And so yes, I think that when people understand that transparency is available and there are conversations around explainability that need to be had, and that debiasing is a possibility, then they are excited. But all of that comes with, you know, precise conversations and some understanding of, you know, the right use case for the right type of AI.
I think just this has been fantastic. I think I'd like to wrap this up with sort of an observation I have, and then I'd love to get your view on it, which is that back in the 2018-19, I sort of led policy on AI for the Bureau. And one of the things when I did a canvas of industry was that I saw a lot of really exciting things happening in the fintech space, but many of the larger banks were concerned about really using AI because of regulatory framework and also the risk. The regulatory framework was, how do I explain adverse actions in a way that is transparent to consumers, transparent to regulators, doesn't get me in trouble with class action litigators. And so there wasn't as much use. So question number one is that still where we are today, or are people starting to get more comfortable with some of these models? And the second thing is, after we do that question, I'd love to get your view on, hey, going back to that credit union or auto lender or other type of person who's listening to this podcast, how do you approach all these legislative approaches? How do I do my job and also keep an eye on what's out there? So maybe we can do the first one first. First one is, are large lenders getting more comfortable with underwriting models, and how do we get them there? Let's start with that one.
So I do think that lenders are getting more comfortable with models. I do think some of the bigger banks, are being somewhat conservative. I do think that the models, you know, of course, a lot of them have the capacity to build their own. But, you know, from what we are understanding, mainly in talking to regulators and talking to some of the banks, is that, you know, they're kind of going slow. The technology itself is there to produce these adverse action reason codes, and that's needed for compliant use for underwriting purposes, right? Having accurate adverse action notices is also not AI dependent, right? Like the discussion around adequate disclosures and what disclosures do and don't do for consumers, we know is something that is a topic in and of itself. Like that's its own podcast. But certainly there's been a lot of great work on thinking about sort of like how to frame policy conversation around that. You know, our technology provides those reason codes that are wired under ECOA and under so the Equal Credit Opportunity Act and the Fair Credit Reporting Act. FinReg Lab, the think tank, has done
awesome. Everybody, FinReg Lab, watch their stuff. They do great work. That's my
yes, exactly. They Zest AI was one of six or seven companies that was part of their machine learning explainability research that they just conducted over the last couple of years. So there's really a lot of great work in that. And so I do think that, you know, the word is getting out, you know, and banks are thinking about, you know, not just the use this. I mean, this is a very specific use that Zest is using, but they're thinking about the consumer facing use of AI, you know, whether that's chatbots and that type of thing. And there, you know, there really are, I think, trying to be thoughtful. When we're talking to, you know, the smaller folks, I think they actually lean in a little bit more, you know, and right. Some of that is just things can move a little faster in a smaller organization. And I think also they've got specific needs. Like in the conversations I've had over the last year, the bigger banks are sort of like more to the point that you just said, like, oh my goodness, AI, we should be trying to figure out how to use this. And it feels like in the smaller institutions, they're like, look, we need X. Like, we have a problem with fraud, or we have a problem with this. They've already got a thing. They've already got a challenge. And that's what's actually been so rewarding about working at Zest. I mean, I miss my regulations colleagues immensely from the Bureau, you know, but Zest has a similar approach. It's problem solving. And so it's a lot of close contact with that client institution. That client institution has come with a specific problem, you know, and the developers are there, the data scientists, the engineers are like, all right, like, you know, let's tackle this together. And so it's a great feedback loop. You know, we ride along with that institution. We don't just hand them a model and say good luck. So I do think that there's some differentiation among how the institutions are approaching and viewing artificial intelligence.
And for the person who says, gosh, do I need to worry about what's going on in Congress this year? What would you say to that compliance officer? Should they, can they just keep doing their work, or should they adjust and pivot, or any thoughts in terms of AI about how they're doing their daily job from a legislative perspective?
Yeah, I mean, I think if they're in financial services, if they cue to the model risk management guidance that's out there, and if they are able to explain the they don't need to be data scientists, right? But they should be able to adequately operate and understand the technology that they're using. So, I mean, if they are sticking with their prudential guidance, and if they are sticking with, having something that's in their midst that they can explain to someone in three sentences at least, they are well on their way. Because I do think that financial services as a sector, we already have in place. We're already thinking about a lot of the things that what that these bills and these laws already are proposing, right? Like, so, consumer disclosure. So that might be something like, they want people to know that they're interacting with artificial intelligence. They want people to make sure that they have checked this technology for potential discrimination. So we already need to do that. And so as long as you're doing that, and you can say and establish that your tech has been tested for disparate impact, tested for disparate treatment, what's the data that's being inputted? All those things should be things you're doing anyway. These are things that you'll be well positioned to, and if there happens to be a bill or a state law that says, hey, you need to document that you've tested your model for fair lending and for discrimination purposes, you should already have a way to pull that information together, right? It's
Right,
going to be an extra step. It's going to be, another compliance thing that you're going to have to do, but you should have that information at hand. So, at least for the compliance officer in a financial institution who's using AI, if your tech is sitting within your current structure and not something that's outside that you don't really know what it's doing, then, like I said, you should be well positioned. If you are using something that you don't know what's happening, then that's something that you should address immediately.
well, there you go. Words of wisdom from an expert. And frankly, we've had a master class here on AI policy. Thank you so much, Yolanda. I just want to give you one last chance. Is there anything that we didn't cover in this discussion that you wanted to just make sure our listeners had a chance to talk about, or
Yeah, no, that is a great question. I do think that that listeners should really engage. And so, to the extent that there's a listener who's in this space who has a perspective to share, especially if they're close to this technology or close to the use of the technology, or they really think that it's an important, improvement for what that is that they're trying to do, talk to your policymaker, talk to your regulator. Folks perceive that there's maybe some hostility or some unwillingness to listen, and those conversations need to keep going. So, find your good point of contact so that everyone can stay informed, because more than anything, I would hate for, some framework to kind of come down that just doesn't really work for us and doesn't really make sense when we already have so much in place in financial services that could actually inform, what's happening on the Hill and in states, and maybe help other sectors that haven't been grappling with these issues like we have, help some of those other sectors along, and for the benefit of all of us.
Well, thank you so much, Yolanda. And this is just a reminder to both keep your politicians informed and by listening to this podcast to stay informed. I'm Tom Oshiewicz. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Tom.